on this episode of Still Loading, Austin Wintory. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Still Loading. For this week's episode, I am super happy to say I had the pleasure of interviewing Austin Wintory. And Austin is a composer who is most famous for the soundtrack of Journey, the Grammy-nominated soundtrack for Journey. Austin was such a nice person and honestly one of the smartest people I've ever, I guess, met, because we did this all over phone, but still, one of the most incredibly intelligent people I've ever met. I'm really happy he set time aside to talk to me today, and we got to talk about a whole lot of different things, so I'm really excited for you all to listen to the episode. Just a little disclaimer, the audio fluctuates a little bit, but it all sounds crisp. You'll hear me kind of repeating myself a little bit once the interview actually gets started. And the one thing I would like to say is I was very nervous doing this, so I sound very low energy, a little bit more than normal, and that's why I was just super nervous, because I tell Austin this in the episode, but the soundtrack to Journey meant so much to me, and a chance to interview the composer for it was literally a dream come true. So it was such a pleasure to interview him, and I could not be happier with the outcome. So without further ado, here is my interview with Austin Wintory. Hello all, and welcome to this new episode of Still Loading. I am beyond excited to have on the show for one of my few interviews, Austin Wintory. For those who do not know him, he is the composer of the Grammy-nominated soundtrack Journey, as well as numerous other indie games, as well as some AAA titles like Assassin's Creed Syndicate, and he's also done a number of films as well. So Austin, first off, how are you doing?
I'm very well. This is an interesting week, because in a couple of days I'm shooting off to Paris for the world premiere of this new thing that I honestly have no idea how the results will be of Ubisoft's Assassin's Creed Symphony, which is like a 2-hour show retrospective of music from every game by like a half a dozen composers, including my stuff from Syndicate. So I have no clue what they've done with it. I was not involved in the show at all. But the first time that it's going to be played before it kind of does a little bit of a world tour is literally this weekend, in Paris. And I'm excited. So I have no idea what I'm walking into. I'm sure they will be pulling out all the stops, and it's going to be completely mind blowing, and surreal to be a part of. But, yes, that's why I am good in a way that is not typical.
That's really incredible. I mean, I've kind of been keeping track of your career ever since Journey, and I know you've done a lot of video game music concerts, like video game music. I think you did video game music live, right? Or video games live. I know there was a whole Journey concert that you did.
Yeah, both. So video games live is Tommy Tallarico's baby that he's been doing for like 15 years or something now. And they've performed music of mine on a bunch of shows. They've done Journey quite a few times. We've done bits from Banner Saga 1 and 2. We've done Assassin's Creed Syndicate. I'm trying to think if there's something else. And he's also had me come in and guest conduct. Like, I remember I conducted in one of the shows, like some Mass Effect and Snake Eater from Metal Gear Solid, and you know, it's really fun show. It's kind of an orchestra rock concert that's like with fog machines and lasers and really over the top, and so that's a blast. But then you're referencing of the Journey Live, that's its own show where we do the whole game as one concert where the whole thing is played live by people on stage.
Oh, that's amazing.
And we have like a chamber orchestra that I'm conducting, where we recreate the score completely and totally in front of the audience. And so it's not pre-choreographed with the player. They're truly free to wander the world of the game and do whatever they want, and potentially connect online to other players And you know, with all the sort of unknown variables that that brings.
So the orchestra has to...
We roll with it and do the... Sorry, what'd you say?
No, finish what you're saying.
Well, and therefore we have to kind of roll with whatever happens. And it's really hard to conduct because you don't know when, you know, you're going to be shifting. And it's not like just performing a set list. We recreate the whole score in every detail, more or less. And the music in game is super interactive and really tightly wrapped around what the player is going to be doing. So, you know, it took like a year to figure out how to even put that on stage in a totally live way. And then as many times as I've conducted it, it's been 3 years now of doing the show all over the country. It's still so daunting and terrifying every time because sometimes players will do stuff that you just don't expect. In fact, every time at some point in the show, a player will do something like that. And it's always hilarious, but it's also like you're sweating bullets for 2 hours straight and there's never a break or a pause or anything. We just play straight through the whole thing. So it's totally insane, but it's really fun.
That's incredible. I didn't know that that's what that exactly was. That reminds me of, it's nowhere near to that scale, but have you ever heard of like a band called Bit Brigade? It's so hard to pronounce.
Not only am I aware of them and the fact that they tag team, you know, they'll play through, I'm blanking on what games.
Mega Man 2, Legend of Zelda, Kid Icarus.
Yeah. So that their spiel obviously is, you know, like these timed out performances in a respect, or in one sort of angle, they are kind of the diametric opposite because they very tightly choreograph it to the point that it is astonishing feats of coordination. Whereas ours is just rolling with the punches. I'm familiar with them because they often play at MAGFest in Washington, D.C., and the very first ever performance of Journey Live was there also, I think 3 years ago. So we came onto each other's radars in the same weekend for doing similar things.
That's really cool. And arguably, at least in my opinion, I think on doing Journey Live, I would say it would be almost more difficult just because, like you said, you have to be able to think on your feet. Not just you. It's not just a band of four players or four musicians, a drummer, a guitarist, and whatnot, but you have an entire orchestra having to pay close attention to what's happening on the screen and being able to react and improvise on a second's notice.
Yeah, the way it works is that the player is just playing the game and then I'm watching the screen like a hawk and the musicians all have to watch me because I have all these hand signals that tell them what to do. One of the things that's cool is we realized the show would not really be possible if we were performing the traditional way where the musicians have, you know, their stands in front of them with the sheet music printed out where periodically they have to reach forward and turn a page. Yeah. So we went and got a bunch of iPad Pros with these little Bluetooth foot pedals where they can turn the page with their feet and they never, ever, ever stop playing because it would be impossible to do basically since sometimes there's page turns with no warning at all and they have to be able to just jump, you know, unexpectedly to something that none of us were, you know, thinking was going to happen. And, yeah. But the sound can't stop. Like it has to be just like in the game, you know, obviously you don't have this problem if you're just at home playing the game. And so the goal is to do something as authentic to that experience as possible. And, the whole Bluetooth foot pedal thing is kind of the way we managed to do it. And it's amazingly, you know, seamless as a result. The musicians, they make it look easy. And part of it is that it's the same musicians every time. It's a group out of Chicago called Fifth House Ensemble. It's not a pickup group in whichever city we're in. We all fly to wherever we're going.
That makes sense.
The same musicians for 3 years, and they basically have the whole score memorized at this point. And so they've gotten really good at making everything completely and totally seamless.
That's honestly incredible. That blows my mind. That takes so much coordination. And I didn't even think about the logistics of not being able to just flip the page on the music on your stand. I was in concert band when I was in high school. I'm I don't consider myself a musician. I play trombone, but I never really truly learned how to read bass clef. So,
That would be challenging.
I just wrote the slide positions down a lot. That was pretty much my go-to. I started out with trumpet and moved to trombone, but like, I'm just picturing having to transition like on a dime to completely different sections. Like that's a really smart idea to use the you said iPads, I think, but the tablets, I mean.
Yeah, and that was their idea. That's the musicians doing it. It was one of those that I just remember thinking, well, this is going to be interesting. And they were like, yeah, no, it's not actually possible any other way.
No, that makes sense. Before we move on, because I could talk about Journey all day long, but I don't want to focus on just that. Journey was what I first was introduced to your music. I mean, I guess not surprisingly, since it was Grammy nominated, but since you've probably already done so many interviews, I don't want to dwell on it too much on it, but I just want to like kind of talk about it for a quick second. What was it like to get it nominated? How did you find out? I don't know. It's gotta be I think it's still the only video game soundtrack to date to be nominated for Grammy. I know Christopher Tin won for his song, but not for a full soundtrack. Correct?
Yeah, it's a funny story, and the details of it sometimes get a little technical because it's always important to me if this subject comes up that we kind of break it down the correct way, because I never want, particularly you cut to the chase of it a bit. I never want Chris's achievement to feel undercut, because he did this monster of a hit opening song from Civilization IV that everybody knows and loves, Baba Yetu. And after it came out and was such a hit, he thought, I should do a whole album of music like this. And so that's where he created Calling All Dawns, which is basically a kind of a mashup orchestra meets various musicians from around the world singing in their kind of local, folk traditions or ethnic traditions, that kind of thing. You know, there's various African and Japanese and European and Latin musical traditions all represented in mixed with this big lush symphony orchestra. And so he made the first track, Baba Yetu, you know, the familiar kind of hit single that then becomes the first track of this big song cycle, this big symphonic opus. And the whole thing is brilliant. It's just, you know, he put a lot of time and resources into it. So it's all several years after Civilization IV has come out, and he releases this solo album that got nominated for 2 Grammys, and he won both of them. One was in the category of classical crossover, which ironically they got rid of, and so therefore he's the last ever winner of that category. and then the other was specifically for Baba Yetu in one of the technical categories called Best Instrumental Arrangement Accompanying Vocals. So theoretically, he won a Grammy for the way he used the orchestra, you know, in support of the Soweto Gospel Choir, which forms the sort of backbone of Baba Yetu. So, you know, the Grammy has a handful of technical categories like engineering and mix and surround sound and all kinds of things like that. You know, it's almost 90 total categories. And this is one of the technical ones. But because it was specifically for Baba Yetu, which he had originally written for a video game, he definitely has the distinction of writing the first ever Grammy nominated and winning, and only winning, video game music spoken in that kind of abstract way. Yeah. The differentiation with Journey was that a few years later, Journey was nominated in the actual soundtrack category, as you know, an entity unto itself. So it wasn't about some, you know, component of Journey being extracted and put on a new album, which then won. It won kind of as in its native state.
Yes.
And all the other nominees were movie scores, because that's what that the category is called, best soundtrack for visual media, and TV, film, and games are all eligible. And the funny thing is that games have been eligible since 1999. And it's sort of criminal that in all that time, you know, Halo and BioShock and even like Portal, there's been a lot of scores that have come out that should have been before Journey. So I've always considered it equally prideful and shameful to have this distinction, because it's not like Journey is the first that should be considered worthy, if we're even willing to accept that it's worthy.
I mean,
and similarly, since then, the fact that none have been nominated is also kind of blasphemous to me, because there have been so many great scores since then, you know, like Darren Korb's work on games like Bastion and Transistor and just innumerable others. So, but anyway, the little kind of cherry on top of the story or all the kind of breakdown of it is that I knew that it had been submitted, and I've been a Recording Academy member for many years, long before it was nominated. And so I was used to the annual tradition of people sending their music and saying, hey, check it out. It's been submitted for the Grammys. If you dig it, maybe consider voting for it, that kind of thing. And you get a lot of these CDs or links to people's albums in every category you can imagine, you know, rock, country, hip hop, R&B, Latin, tropical Latin, children's, spoken word. I get like 1,000 albums sent to me every year, and so does every other member of the Academy.
Holy crap.
And so Journey was, you know, in that mix, and I had no reason to expect anything. And then the funny thing was that the nominations were announced, and I was in my car, and my phone rings, and it was Chris. And he said, did you see the nominations? And I said, no, read it. And he read through the list, and Journey was in there. And then it dawned on both of us simultaneously the beautiful poetry that he, of all people, would happen to be the one to have called me.
That's pretty amazing.
And because it's not like he had insider information. He just refreshed the website to see what the nominees were and then picked up the call to just say, hey, how cool is this? Figuring I already knew. and I was like, dude, I love that you're the one calling me right now. It was awesome. So yeah, credit where it's due. Chris definitely made video game and Recording Academy history. And Journey, I suspect Journey's nomination, you know, in the soundtrack category would largely not have been possible. You know, no one would have noticed it probably were it not for the seal having been broken from Bobby Yaitu.
I definitely agree with that, because it's all building off each other, and I'm really hoping, like, I agree with you. It's criminal that no other game soundtracks have been nominated or recognized by the Academy yet. I guess there's still that stigma of, like, video games aren't quote unquote art, even though that's, you know, completely subjective.
I honestly don't think it's stigma. I don't think people are intentionally voting against them, like trying to push them away. You have to remember there's several hundred, like literally north of 200 eligible scores every year. And it doesn't take a very long list it doesn't take much to suddenly have 5 or 6 nominees and be done. And considering the caliber of work that's done in film and television every year, I mean, there's just as much blasphemy, you know, in every direction, essentially, because it's hard to pick them. I mean, blasphemy is clearly the wrong word for it, because everybody has their favorites. For example, you know, there's been like 7 years of Game of Thrones soundtrack releases, and only last year did it ever get nominated for the first time. You know, there's plenty of people that would say, how in the hell has Game of Thrones been ignored time after time after time after time? And you could make the same case. Well, I guess there's stigma against television. And it's like, well, no, there's just a lot of really good shit.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the other nominees when Journey was nominated were Hans Zimmer for The Dark Knight Rises, Howard Shore, you know, 3-time Oscar-winning composer of the Lord of the Rings films for the movie Hugo, Martin Scorsese movie, John Williams for the Spielberg movie Tintin, Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and There Who Won, and then also a composer that people don't really ever remember his name, but Ludovic Boris, the French composer, who had just won the Oscar for the silent French film called The Artist. So none of those are, you know, deep cuts, as it were. They're all high profile, well-known composers, well-known projects. And so it's utterly flabbergasting that Journey somehow managed to find itself in there. I don't think it's because everyone was like, well, I was going to vote for a video game, but I hate those, so I guess I'll vote for John Williams. You know what I mean?
That's really comforting to hear, though. Sorry to cut you off.
I think it's not stigma. It's mostly lack of awareness. I think that there's just a lot of folks that still think video games are 8-bit chiptunes, which side note, as if that also should be somehow unworthy, which I think we would both agree is not the case.
I love
chiptune
music.
For people that live and die by, you know, the album world, because remember, the Recording Academy is not the game industry, nor is it the film industry. It's the music industry. It's mostly the people who want to be the next Taylor Swift or Beyonce or Chick Corea or Herbie Hancock or Quincy Jones or Frank Zappa. You know, like it's the so-called musical artists world, which is also, side note, why I think it was very predictable that Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross would win when I was nominated, because they are Nine Inch Nails. This is their territory. All the rest of us are in their space. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a huge shock. And also not undeserving. I mean, I think that they're pretty brilliant. I admittedly wasn't as crazy about The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, but the score to like The Social Network and Atticus's solo score for the movie, The Book of Eli, I think are spectacular works. I mean, they're the real deal, not to mention that I really love Nine Inch Nails anyway. So, you know, no one's losing any sleep. To me, it was 7 years ago, and it's still surreal to me as if it happened yesterday.
Well, I'm super thankful I got nominated, only for the fact that I'll be the first person to say I can be pretty dense at times. So when I'm playing games, I don't necessarily always notice all the craftsmanship that goes into everything, not just, you know, the visual stuff, but the music. I don't always pay attention to the music. So when I was playing Journey for the first time, your soundtrack was literally one of the first ones in a very long while that completely stood out to me, that I actually had to stop playing the game just to listen to it. And that doesn't happen often. That's not to say I have these fine, refined tastes and I know what I'm talking about. It's more just like I said before, I'm dense. I don't notice things.
No,
so
well,
it's impressive to me when stuff, it's impressive to me when stuff like jumps out to the forefront, even to me, when I'm not always 100% paying attention.
Well, you're very kind, but in fairness to all the other scores that you may not have noticed, Journey is designed to put the music at the front of the experience. When we were working on it, we kind of referred to the music as the narrator, because the theme is abstract enough that it was always clear, particularly from Genova Chen, the creative director, that some kind of grounding element to really make it clear to the player sort of what's happening was going to be important. And he didn't want to rely on voiceover. He didn't want to put text on screen. Wanted it to be as universal and easily sort of transmissible all over the world as possible, to kind of, you know, because the game is all about attacking these very universal themes and this sort of Joseph Campbell monomyth, you know, the hero's journey.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he said, you know, we're going to be relying on music. You know, he kind of would say it jokingly, like, you know, don't blow this. We're counting on you. And I felt the weight of that through the whole production. It was 3 years of work, because I knew that the music was in such a front and center place that there was no way to hide, which meant I really had to kind of step up to the table or step up to the plate, because, if it sucked, it would tear the whole game down. You know, I would be the guy that ruined this beautiful piece of art they were making. And so I lived in that fear for every second of the 3 years we were working on it. So it's not that you are not noticing game scores. It's that most games use their score in a much more supportive and accompanimental way, the way most films or television do. It's there as part of the overall alchemy of the experience. It's not there to be a showcase for the music. But Journey is kind of abnormal in that the music, the game all but is designed to feature the score instead of the other way around.
Fair. That makes sense. It's opposed, like, soundtracks designed to be atmospheric, to kind of reinforce the whole, not the mood, but the immersion that that the game is trying to make the player experience.
Yeah, well, I'd say you were spot on also. You're absolutely correct, but mood is not the wrong word. In fact, that's a word that developers bring up with me, on practically every project, where to them, score is very much about setting the mood, and then all the particulars of the narrative are being communicated other ways. But with Journey, it was like, no, when X happens, the music needs to reflect that and needs to reflect it very unsubtly, because that's going to be the main way that the player knows that X just happened.
What the emotion the developer is trying to shoot for.
Yep, exactly.
All right. And speaking of just writing scores and stuff like that, one of my first questions that I actually have on my list here is, you've composed for a lot of different things, music for films as well as games. But I noticed that you're drawn to game soundtracks a lot. What draws you to compose music for video games? And I notice you also do a lot of indie games on top of that. What draws you to either A, indie games, or just B, just video game music in general?
Well, I honestly love it all. I've actually done far more movies than games. You've just never heard of any of them.
Fair enough.
Yeah, well, I've just done piles of indie films that they come out, they play in some festivals, they migrate onto iTunes or Netflix or DVD or whatever, and then the world moves on. We tend to live in a world where, you know, the film industry has gotten such that to be competitive, you know, the big giant tentpole blockbusters tend to be the ones that get noticed the most, because they throw hundreds of millions of dollars at their marketing, because they have to, because, you know, there's probably over 1,000 new movies released every year, at least. Mm-hmm. I remember a couple of years ago looking that it was like in 2014 or something, the New York Times reviewed 995 movies or something like that during the calendar year. There's a lot of content out there. It's a great time to be a movie fan, because there's an unlimited supply of new stuff and lots of really interesting stuff made by filmmakers, but you have to go find it because there's just such market saturation. Short version is, I've done a lot of movies, just not the $200 million ad campaign movies, but I love it all. I love storytelling at the end of the day. And of course, I'm also a big gamer. I've been a gamer my whole life, even before becoming a musician. So games were something that were always really important to me. And I'll say, you're not wrong in your kind of assessment today. These days, I do more movies than games. I just did so many movies for so many years that the overall total is still in the movie's favor. And I love them. I mean, I've done one this year and have another one coming up soon, and possibly one more at the end of the year. So there's always a steady stream, but games definitely dominate the landscape of my life. And I can't exactly be unhappy about that, because games are amazing. The game developers tend to be some of the most creative and interesting and open-minded and curious people I could imagine, which is a dream partnership to have. And the fact that games are so diverse, the game mechanics, the kinds of stories people want to tell, the scope, you know, from very small, intimate games like Florence to big, giant, sprawling, you know, Horizon Zero Dawn or the latest, like the Insomniac Spider-Man or Assassin's Creed Odyssey, like the scope of ginormous games down to hyper intimate and everything in between is so massive that it's just endlessly inspiring. I just kind of go where I am excited, and it's a spoil of riches, frankly, because there's so much exciting stuff everywhere you look.
All right. Well, I only got a couple more questions for you. Kind of off of all your work, all the stuff you have done work for. One other thing I read up online is that you're very passionate about promoting music education. And I read that you do a lot of promoting to have schools promote the arts more. So what would you like to see schools do more of for the arts to kind of, I guess, raise awareness, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, well, it means a lot that you would ask me that, because it's something I don't talk about. I'm not asked about it very often, but it's something I spend a lot of my free time, as it were, doing. I'm on the board of directors of an education nonprofit called Education Through Music Los Angeles, which is etmla.org. And there are a lot of music education charities out there. There's a very famous one called the Harmony Project. There's the Mr. Holland's Opus Foundation. The Harmony Project, for example, does subsidized or paid for or heavily discounted after school music education for kids, you know, so that if your school can't, you know, afford a band program, you can you know, the Harmony Project will come in and offer one that you can take after school instead.
That's really cool.
Mr. Harlan's Opus Foundation, you know, does instrument drives where people will donate, you know, their violins, their guitars, their cellos, that kind of thing. And then they give them to schools in order to help the school, because, you know, these instruments can be very expensive, even student ones, you know, like if the cello that Yo-Yo Ma plays is $1 million cello, and if the cello that the principal of the New York Philharmonic plays is, you know, $100,000 cello, even an elementary school student cello is going to be like $1,000. And so, or, you know, $600-$700 or something like that. So it's just, for a lot of schools, that's just a budget. And what do you do with one? You know, you need like 10.
Yeah.
So the Mr. Holland's Opus Foundation, for example, raises money in order to buy instruments to give to schools. Also very amazing. The big difference with those kinds of programs, and there's many others as well, with our program, is that we believe that music education is essentially a right of education. So we are an in-school program, a mandatory part of the curriculum. So the way our program works is we've developed, you know, a K-5, 6-year proprietary sequential curriculum. So you learn music the way you learn every other subject. You know, you don't randomly skip around math. You learn, you know, basic counting. Then you learn addition and subtraction. From there, you're able to extrapolate to fractions and multiplication and division and things like that. And on your way all the way up till, you know, calculus and onwards. And it's designed to be a kind of tiered ladder. And music education so often is just this scattershot of, hey, let's sing this now, let's learn our scales now, let's this and that, and it doesn't take, because nothing builds on anything. You don't use what you learned yesterday in order to advance what you're learning today. So our program is very much, it's K-5 for every child in the school, and we work with the principal and say, you know, okay, next year we're going to launch, you know, music class in your school. So we need a commitment that every child in that school at every grade level, no matter where they come from or who they are or what they can afford or anything, they will have access to this. So it requires a commitment from the school to treat it as seriously as they would science and math and anything else. Because music is very often one of the first things to go when the budget cuts come. You know, it's like, okay, well, let's get rid of all the luxuries. So music and the arts, you know, that's number one. And shortly after that, you know, is going to be like sports or things like that for elementary school level, you know, until eventually, you know, it's like, we would rather cut the janitor before we would cut math and science, for example. And I've seen that happen, especially in LA. And you would think LA would be, you know, the hotbed of music education, considering that it's the hotbed for practically all the world's art. I mean, so much movie content, television content, video game content, you know, albums. I mean, there's just so much that's made here. You would think our schools would be bursting with education for these various kinds of things. And it's a nightmare. I mean, it's just this giant wasteland of schools that cut it decades ago and have been limping along ever since. And the crazy thing is that the statistical analyses that have been done over and over and over and over at all different kinds of schools show over and over how much return on investment there is from music for young kids. And it comes down into the world of neuroplasticity and of the brain developing these pathways, where learning music is not about learning music when you're K-5. It's about learning how to think. It's about expanding your capacity to learn new stuff. And music has the ability to stimulate the brain's ability to learn new information far and away better than anything else. So when people say, oh, my kid took music and then they got better at math, that must be because music helps, you know, with counting and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, that's bullshit. That's so superficial. Music helps literally everything in your brain at that age. And it helps it in a way that nothing else can compete with or compare with. Because it uses the brain in a way that's so novel from all the others. Never mind that music is a social activity. So we get feedback over and over and over of, oh, you know, my son was very quiet and I think he's on the spectrum and he has a hard time relating to other kids. But then, bam, 1 month in music class and he's the most popular kid in school because he found that outlet that he couldn't find in any other way. And we hear stories like that over and over and over and over. So, yeah, we have tens of thousands of students. We're in like 40 schools or so now. We've been, you know, every year expanding. I was there from the very beginning when it was a tiny little startup and it was just a few of us. And now, you know, it's a multi-million-dollar operation that's got a pretty robust staff and a bunch of amazing teachers. And we try to make really special experiences for our kids because we specifically target inner city schools, underfunded schools, people, you know, where 99% mm-hmm. of the school are on food stamps and things like that. We go for the areas that need it the most. We're not in Beverly Hills awesome. And Westwood and places like that. We're in Compton and South Central and Watts and downtown and Chinatown and in those kinds of neighborhoods. And we do fun things like I remember years ago, 12 years ago, I took a group of, I think, third or fourth graders to the Sony scoring stage, and we all got to sit and watch Michael Giacchino and Brad Bird record the score to Ratatouille, for example.
Goodness.
And, you know, it's a hell of an experience for like a 7-year-old kid to get to see. And Brad Bird brought the Oscar he had won for The Incredibles and like was letting him play with it. And we've done, you know, innumerable things like that, over the years. There's a lot of composer colleagues of mine who are also involved who will offer up things like that. You know, on and on and on. I could go on forever about it, but you are not wrong. It's really important to me. It's one of those that I think the reason why I'm passionate about it is not actually because I'm a composer, but because I care about trying to do my part to contribute to a broadly literate, broadly educated society. And music is an incredibly disproportionately powerful tool to creating that. It's basically coincidence that I am a musician and I am a composer, and that's how I earn my living. Because this would be true irrespective of if that was my passion. And in fact, our board of directors, for example, is full of, you know, lawyers and accountants and mm-hmm. engineers and, you know, what people that are not musicians at all, but recognize, you know, oh, you know, it occurs to me, I played violin as I was a kid, and here, you know, then I went to Harvard and got an MBA, and now I'm a lawyer, you know, or whatever. That, you get what I mean? Like,
no,
a lot of people that recognize this is not, you don't train kids in music just in the hopes that you create this army of future musicians.
I 100% agree. One more time before I go into what I was going to say was, what is the name of the organization again, just so everyone can hear it one more time?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, thank you for prompting this, because it's something that, I mean, it's probably fairly obvious that this is something that I'm passionate about, but I really don't get asked about it very often because I give a lot of money to the group every year. I do fundraisers. You know, I just donate my own money, but I try to create events. Like, I'll do things on my birthday and say, everything you buy from my Bandcamp today, I'm going to give to charity. So please, you know, if you can afford an extra dollar for an album, it's not going to me. And, you know, had some really successful fundraiser drives that way, in the past. And so anyway, as much as I'm passionate about it, I don't get to talk about it that often. It's Education Through Music Los Angeles, etmla.org.
Education Through Music Los Angeles. Okay.
Yeah. I was just going to say the Los Angeles part is because we are technically a franchise of what began in New York. The program is 20 plus years running in New York. If you went to just ETM, Education Through Music, .org, you would reach the New York office, and not to siphon dollars away from our LA one, but obviously if someone, for example, who hears this lives in New York and wants to support their local community, ETM is there as well, and could always use the support. So I would hate to paint the picture incorrectly.
No, I like listening to people who are passionate about something, and not just like, obviously you're passionate about your profession, otherwise you wouldn't be doing it for as long as you have been. But it's, for me, like, one of the things that I like is when even if I don't know anything about it, I like listening to people who are passionate about something, because it kind of gets me almost motivated to not just focus, not just to about that specific topic, but also to what I'm doing. And, or just, you know, podcasting or whatever I have going on in my life. But I 100% agree with what you're saying, how important music is. Cause like I said, I'm not a musician, but I was in band, a concert band from fourth grade up into my senior year of high school. And it helped me out a lot, not just in terms of socially, I met a lot of great people there, but also, I think it helped me think more critically, cause I would have to start, like, especially when I, think critically, because you're learning to read music and you're learning not just scales, but you're just learning patterns and other stuff like that. But also, improvisation. Like, even if it's not necessarily improvisation in terms of music, but like learning to sight read can help you in other things than just sight reading.
For sure. I mean, that's the thing. All of it can very quickly become some kind of analog or metaphor for some other thing.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a simple example. If I write a piece for choir and I'm using as text for them to sing some poem about, you know, love, but because I understand how to read poetry, it's clear that the poem is, you know, an idealistic, an ironically idealistic take on love that is hiding the fact that the poet feels burned and scorned by some lover.
Mm-hmm.
And they are intentionally, ironically dressing it up with ultra sugary, flowery language to communicate that. Let's say I don't know anything about poetry, but I sing in the choir a piece of music that's like really oddly dark and full of, you know, venom. Meanwhile, the words that are coming out of my mouth are talking about how wonderful love is and transcendent and blah, blah, blah. Just the very act of doing that would probably make me say, what the hell was this poem about? And so there you have this whole literary world that might open up to you purely through the act of wondering, you know, what was going on in this music? And that's the brain actually sorting through it. The biggest impact all of this has is in the subconscious, is in the literal wiring of the brain. Like I was saying, if you read, for example, Oliver Sacks' book, Musicophilia, he talks about the impact on neuroplasticity and the ability to absorb new information as impacted by music from a young age. And it's not trivial.
I mean, this is me technically just for lack of a better term, speaking out of my ass. But like, if you think about it, like people have known music longer than they've known writing. Like, you don't need to be able to write to, like, you need to be able to write or read to write a book, right? But if you don't need to learn how to read music or write music to be able to create music. So it's been,
That's a modern manifestation, you know, of what anthropologists have been, you know, paleoanthropologists have been hypothesizing for a long time, is that music very likely predates language itself. Humans and proto-humans were making music by banging stuff together and by using their vocal cords before they actually had vocabulary, which is pretty astonishing to think about. It makes you realize there's probably a really good reason why music has such a primal impact on us compared to, you know, you can go see a play and your, you know, brain engages and you feel moved and you feel excited and you learn something, or from a movie or from a video game or whatnot. But music seems to have this unique way to communicate with us in non-rational terms. It seems to reach our heart before our brain even realizes what it's hearing. And I don't know of any other art forms that really seem to lay claim to that. It's as though we're kind of tapping into something cosmic in a way, not to sound like a kind of new age, you know, crystal power healer type person, but it's as though we're tapping into something truly universal in the sense that we conventionally say that, but of the universe, instead of this beautiful art form that's sort of testament to the creativity and ingenuity of humans. My little catchphrase there is to say, one of the things that I think makes music incredible is that, unlike so many other art forms, we didn't really invent it so much as discover it.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
I can't really back that up. It just seems to be the case. I can't back it up academically, but considering that it would predate so much of our modern intellect, it seems like there's got to be some truth to it.
No, I think it sounds profound enough. I'm just going to proclaim it as fact. So,
well, I appreciate it.
All right, to kind of wrap everything up, because I know you had a little bit of a tight schedule, so I didn't want to like take up too much of your time. Some last couple things. Do you have any upcoming projects that you would like to promote?
Yeah. So, in theory, by the time this is in people's ears,
it might already be
out. A project will have been announced and released.
Out.
Yep, exactly. Announced and released should be this new game from Sony called Erica. It's developed by a London studio that, you know, it's their debut title, called FlavorWorks. The creative director is a guy named Jack Attridge, who I met at the Game Developers Conference completely out of nowhere several years ago, when he showed me a demo of a game that he was making that instantly blew my mind, because the basics were, he wanted to revisit this cursed FMV or full motion video genre that had yielded not exactly the best ever games like Night Trap or Sewer Shark in the 90s. Beloved as they may be, I think they get to ride the nostalgia train more
it's
than
a little
the
bit more
sort of,
ironically liking them versus exactly.
I think that's the case, because I mean, God knows I played Sewer Shark. That game came with the Sega CD, and I remember I played the living shit out of it. But when I go back and I look at, you know, capture of it on YouTube these days, I think, my Lord, it's so bad. But A for effort, you know, they tried. They were saying, okay, look, we have the ability to actually record footage of actors. Surely that's going to be interesting. We already know movies are popular and TV's popular. But the technology was really behind. Actually, not just that. My hypothesis is that everyone who ever tried this genre ended up with the worst possible combination of filmmaking and game development, because they basically were a bunch of game designers mm-hmm. that knew nothing about how to make a good movie, and a bunch of filmmakers who knew nothing about how to make a good game. So it's like, I have a choice. Would I rather play the most low fidelity 8-bit, you know, pixelated, you know, Galaga, or some badly acted, horribly shot, you know, non-viable attempt at to bridging the gap between movie lovers and game lovers? And I think by, you know, in droves, people would say, I'll go with my 8-bit pixel art and sound, please, because I actually feel moved by that, because the interactions with that were so superior. So Jack and his company FlavorWorks, published by Sony, said we think we can take a fresh crack at this and solve those problems. And from my perspective, they absolutely did. This game plays like a real game, but it's 100% live action at every moment. They got real, you know, their team consists of, you know, real writers, real filmmakers. You know, I visited the set while they were shooting, and I've been to other movie sets before, and this was no different. It just, obviously, what they were shooting was different, because they had to be able to account for interactivity. But they knew going in exactly how that was all going to work, so they weren't reverse engineering footage that was conceived of like a movie. They were shooting a game. And the actors seemed to understand it, got to know some of the cast members, and everybody seemed to really know what they were doing. And so, you know, it's an exciting prospect into a genre that everybody had every right to think shouldn't exist anymore, because it just proved to just so reliably produce bad games. But Erica, to me, feels like it kind of cracked the code, and a lot was learned. And of course, you know, now that we're finished with it, I talked to Jack and the team, and they're like, okay, now, you know, here's the 10,000 things we learned that we know how to do better next time. But everybody always feels that way. God knows I would say that about everything I've ever worked on. But I think that they've created something truly worth checking out, worth playing. I killed myself writing the score. It was years and years of just endlessly rewriting and throwing things away and rewriting and trying to get the tone just right, because it's sort of a drama / thriller / mystery with a lot of overtones of other things, and just trying to make it not too dark, but heavy enough. And, you know, it was not easy to nail that. But I'm proud of the results, and I've loved working on it.
I love the fact that they're willing to take that risk too, knowing kind of like what the game, let's face it. I mean, I'm a gamer, but, gamers can be a little hostile.
Merciless, yeah.
So I like it when big developers take a risk. I mean, I know the developer is new, but like Sony's taking a risk on them by, publishing it. I'm assuming they're publishing it.
Yeah, they are. And you're spot on. Sony deserves credit for saying, you know what, we're going to give this a chance, because if you could play their original demo that they made as the proof of concept, which is what Sony played and greenlit the game on the back of. You know, they just did a quick little one-day shoot with not even real actors, but just, you know, as a proof of concept for the tech that they developed. Mm-hmm. And that was so damn impressive that as much as, you know, I rightfully agree, Sony deserves a lot of credit for believing in this. You'd be hard-pressed not to if you played that demo, because I remember distinctly I was sitting in the W Hotel in San Francisco at the bar. This guy puts an iPad in my hands and says, just, you know, check this out and talk to me in 5 minutes when you're done. I put on the headphones, and 5 minutes later, I was like, where do I sign? This is amazing. And you know, here we are 3-4 years later and unleashing to the world.
That's truly incredible. I'm definitely going to be picking this up when it comes out on launch. I just to, even if it doesn't, like, cause I haven't played it myself yet, of course. So even if it's not something that I end up enjoying, I'm actually a video game collector. So like things that even I don't personally like, and it doesn't, you know, like doesn't hit the right buttons for me, doesn't necessarily mean of course that it's bad. It, you know, just didn't hit the right buttons for me, but I still like to own it. Because to me, when something's unique, that just makes it that much more interesting. I don't even mean valuable. I just mean I like having unique things in my collection. So this would be like right up my alley.
Well, this one is that. I certainly hope it pushes those buttons for you, but there's no doubt about the novelty of it.
All right. So I think that's all the questions I had for you. Just sincerely, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast for this. This has been a joy for me. Like seriously, like your soundtrack for Journey is one of my favorite soundtracks of all time. I literally listen to it outside of the game because I like it so much.
Well, that means a lot. It's my pleasure to talk with you. And if nothing else, like I said, you gave me a chance to spout off about ETMLA and the work that they do, and that really means a lot because I just don't get that chance very often. So believe me, thank you.
Oh, no problem. I like to talk to people who enjoy what they do, and it's the whole reason I do what I do. So I think that will wrap it all up. So thank you once again, Austin, for joining me.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So that was my interview with Austin, and once again, I can't thank him enough for coming onto the podcast. It was truly an honor to get to talk to him, to get to listen to him talk about what he's passionate about between music education as well as his upcoming game, Erica, which by the time you're hearing this, it will have already been out. So, Austin, sincerely, thank you again. I forgot to ask him when we were recording, but you can follow him on Twitter at awintery on Twitter and a.wintery on Instagram. And wintery is spelled W-I-N-T-O-R-Y. You could also probably see it in the title of the episode, but just in case, awintery on Twitter and a.wintery on Instagram. So, Austin, thank you again. That's his social media stuff. So if you all want to check him out, please go give him a follow. As usual, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. Also, check out the Podbeard Network. You can go to the website, podbeardnetwork.com, to check out all the content we got. If you want to reach out to me, you can contact me on any of those social media, or you can also email me at stillloadingcontact@gmail.com. Feel free to also check out my website, stillloadingpodcast.com. And also, I have a Patreon that I never remember to mention, but patreon.com/stillloadingpod. If you want to support the show, please consider checking it out there. And I think that should do it for me. So thank you all once again for listening, and I will see you all next time.